My name is Erin Star White. I work here at The Modern as an assistant curator of education. I'm very glad you're here today. I prepared some remarks to read. Before we get into the tour today, I wanted to mention that August 2nd is the last Sundays with The Modern talk that will focus on framing desire, and that will be Dr. Catherine Caesar. She's a professor of art history at the University of Dallas. So put that on your calendar. This afternoon, we're fortunate to have artist Misty Kiesler here to talk with us about her work, which focuses on intimate portraits of people and the spaces they occupy. Projects include orphanages in Russia, garbage and e-waste dumps in several countries, her own family, and most notably the Love Hotels of Japan, a series we will see in part this afternoon. Misty's work is included in the permanent collections of the Modern Art Museum of Fort Worth. Yay! The Museum of Fine Art Houston, the Dallas Museum of Art, the Museum of Contemporary Photography in Chicago, the Kiyosato Museum of Photographic Art in Japan, and the Ogden Museum of Southeastern Art. She holds an undergraduate degree from Columbia College, as well as an MFA from Bard College. And I'm sure you're eager to hear from Misty, as am I, so I'll turn it over to you. Thank you.
Great. Thank you. Thank you guys for coming out. So I've selected four or five artists for us to look at and talk about today, and we'll kind of land on Love Hotels at the end. But I chose them, I say four or five, because one of the group of works is two artists that collaborate together. So I chose them really because half the work that we're going to look at focuses on empty interiors, you know, ways of looking at culture with the total absence of people very intentionally. And then the other half of it is looking at interiors with people inside of them. So I guess we can go ahead and proceed up to the exhibit, and we'll walk about halfway through the show and then stop and talk. Right. Okay, so Candida Hofer, or Hofer as I've called her for years and got corrected recently for calling her Hofer instead of Hofer, is the first artist that I want to talk about in this exhibit. This is a piece that she did in a library. And Candida Hofer was one of the students of the Beechers. You know, they made work in the 1920s. They're most known for a series of water towers that they did. And the work that they were doing when it debuted was called New Objectivity. So they were German teachers, and the students that came out of their teaching that are really well known, there's actually three of them represented in this show. One is behind you guys, the Thomas Struth. There's three Thomas Struth pieces in the Framing Desire show. We walked by the Thomas Ruff on our way in. It was that very large portrait. So the Germans who came out of this school really were they're very well known for images that are technically incredible and conceptual at the same time. And so one of the reasons that I was really drawn to their work originally when I first saw it and I was first studying photography is that it's so crisp and incredible. And I'd encourage all of you guys to come up and look really closely at the work. Don't make the security guards too nervous, but you're welcome to just walk up and look really closely. Everything in the image is really crisp and nice. I mean, it's really sharp. And so she's obviously shooting with a large format camera. Her work originally started because she was interested in looking at how German society was changing with an influx of Turkish immigrants coming into the country. And then that work sort of evolved, and she started looking at public institutions. So she was looking at museums and theaters and opera houses and libraries and places where the public kind of comes together. And in that study, she started really looking at architecture. So there's this thing that happens within Hofer's work where we're looking at these places as they're envisioned, and there's sort of this idealism to them, like this level of order that's really impeccable. And even her process, you know, she's very methodical about how she shoots. She shoots, from the front of the space, the back of the space, side to side, and then she shoots any other angles that she's found interesting as she's working through that process. She's only shooting available light. So the light really changes as she's shooting because she is shooting a large format camera. You can see everything is sharp from the very front of the photo to the very back. So that means she's using a large depth of field, which necessarily means that she's going to require more time for each exposure. So that means that as she's photographing these spaces, the light is typically changing, so she's only working with a light that exists. And I just know from experience of shooting with available light that that would also mean in post-production, she's probably doing a lot of burning and dodging, you know, as this series she shot on film. So I love that because she's sort of been tagged as this photographer of empty spaces. I mean, Thomas Struth has worked people into some of his images. Thomas Ruff obviously works with people, that first one that we walked by. But Candida Hofer, you cannot find any of her work that has people in it, or I have yet to see any of them. They're all devoid of people. It's almost like we are the last people left on Earth looking at the shot. You know, what our spaces look like without any people coming through them. And I love in her library series, I mean, you know, we as people are constantly archiving different things. You know, we write books, we write our history down, we are kind of compulsive about having our history contained in these volumes that we can go and reference. So I love this idea that there's this constant sort of reference happening in the photographs to cataloging our history, or, you know, who knows what's contained in all the books that we're looking at, and yet we sort of have the same thing happening with the photograph on the wall in the museum. You know, we have a catalog of this place. So one last thing that I think is really interesting about her work is how it's so much easier to see the play of architecture and how it works within organizing, you know, everything within the room without people in it, because I think it's really evident, you know, it's a nice relationship that's happening in this room, having the Hofer on one side and the Struth on the other, because in the Struth, I think that you really start to focus on the people that are moving around within the spaces. So they become as much a part of the story, you know, how they are reacting to the space and then how we react to the people. That's all contained in the Struth, and yet Hofer completely removes people so that it's just us sort of facing what the architecture is completely empty. Yes? Oh, okay. So burning and dodging. If we take a negative and we print it in the darkroom, then there's a technique that photographers use called burning and dodging. And basically, when you have a negative and you put it in a negative holder, in an enlarger, light projects through that negative onto the paper that's the surface that's actually printed. And so one way that you can control how dark or light elements of the photograph are by blocking part of the light so that more light hits the paper or less light in an area. So if you're, let's say that when she took this photograph, because we can see there's a light source coming in from the window up here, probably this was actually all much brighter if the print were just printed as the image was taken on the negative. So by, you know, in the dark room, sort of controlling it so that more light hits that area, and yet blocking areas like this that were probably properly exposed, she can bring out more detail in that area, or whoever's making the print. And same thing, you know, if an area is darker, just to kind of have a more even exposure. Because you're sort of, when you're photographing with available light, you're sort of at the whim of what's in the space. And, you know, even now in Photoshop, when we do everything digitally, or depending on the artist, I know some artists still work in the darkroom, but even in Photoshop, it's still called burning and dodging those tools. So when I'm teaching students and I'm explaining that, students say, why would you call this burning and dodging? We're just lightening and darkening areas. So. Yes.
Near that window. decide based on the light of the chairs or the way that the, because it seems so well lit and that's only light source.
Right. I mean, there's definitely a light source on this side. I don't know. I mean, I hate to say what I think the other side, but you can tell how much lighter this is.
Yeah, that's kind of.
And my guess would be that this was probably the bottom of the image was much brighter than what we're seeing. You know. Yeah, and it looks so perfect. You know, and really when you're taking lights around with you, you know, and lighting spaces, it's actually pretty easy to throw light in spaces that would be dark that you would lose, and you know. So, any other questions about this photograph? All right, we're gonna actually walk through this room around the corner, and then we'll wind up back in this room after. So our next stop on our talk is the work of Hubbard and Birchler. And it's actually Teresa Hubbard and Alexander Birchler. And Teresa was born in Dublin in 1965, and Alexander was born in Switzerland in 1962. And they started collaborating in 1990. So I already did the math for you. They were in their 20s. They were in an artist in residency program in Banff. And they started collaborating together, and now they're married and partners, and their work is always collaborative. They do a lot of video work. They actually live in Austin. She teaches at the University of Texas, and they both teach at Bard College, and that's where I got my MFA, and they were my absolute favorite teachers, so I was so excited to be in a show with them because I think their work is phenomenal anyways. But I had a real personal connection with them also. So their work is always sort of hinges on this narrative element. But if you guys look, can anyone pick out any story from these photographs?
Individual pictures or together?
No, I mean just individually. Can you piece together a story? Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think that it's interesting that they're giving us these pieces, right? Like, we have this sensation of looking through. I mean, they've called the pieces holes. All these photographs are holes. So they've given us this hole, and then they've given us, you know, this really smart photograph that utilizes depth of field in a way that controls where our eyes focus. So what I mean by that is the front of the photograph, you know, the foreground is not sharp. The stuff in the very background far away is not sharp, but the hands, you know, the elements of the people in the photographs are sharp. So that means that we're actually pulled through the photograph to where they want our eyes to rest. And Hubbard and Birchler build their sets when they make photographs. So these may look like they've encountered these interesting holes and spaces, but I guarantee you that all of these are very carefully constructed just to create these photographs. And I've thought a lot about, you know, they work in film a lot, and they work kind of thinking about suspense and the narrative and how that's built in film. And a lot of times they will give us a lot of pieces of a narrative, but not the whole thing. So so we kind of are forced to draw our own conclusions or be in this space as an audience member where we don't have the full story and we have to kind of be okay with that and looking at their work. But I think constantly about movies that are suspenseful or a little bit uncomfortable where the perspective of the camera is often where the, you know, we're peering through something, right? Like scary movies are known for that, where we sort of have the perspective of the creeper, you know, and the person has no idea that they're being watched. We get a little bit of that element here. I think it's really interesting. One of the ways they've talked about this work in particular is by saying that they are not at all concerned as to whether or not these photographs are true. So I don't think this question is as prominent as it used to be when I first got involved in photography, but I remember I had a few interviews where people would ask me, you know, how do you deal with this idea that people might think that your photograph is manipulated in some way? And, you know, now a little bit of the dialogue around photography is that we understand that when you pull out a camera and you're photographing a person, they act differently just because of the existence of the camera, right? So they change their behavior a little bit anyway. So there's sort of always been this issue around the idea of truth in photography, that when you pull out a camera, behavior changes anyway. So in many ways, that's not the truth. But I love that Hubbard and Birchler removed themselves from that completely by saying right away that that's not an issue they're concerned about in their work. So these are, I'm just going to refer to my notes because I know later I'll kick myself and go, oh, I didn't mention that. You know, they're very fragmented. They give us very few elements. And the work is really open and suggestive for us coming to it. Do you guys have any questions about this? Or? Yes?
Do you think it's a coincidence that all of the looks that we're getting are the midsection of a person? I mean, I don't know, it seems like that's the case in all of these. It could be anybody, you know, they could have focused on any.
Sure. Well, I think it's actually very intentional they're not giving us faces, you know, because we tend to read so much off of faces and photographs and project on them for that reason. Yeah, I mean, I think that's part of the fragmenting that they're doing in all of this work, because you're just given less of the whole person. Yeah, but whether or not, I mean, the fact they didn't give us feet, I don't know.
Yeah,
it'd be a good question for them. Yeah, I don't know. Yes.
This moment, or would it maybe write like a sort of script and then just kind of decide to capture moments inside of that? Was this like, was this one picture a carefully curated moment, or was there an overlying arch that they captured?
I don't know. But based on all their other work, I would say that this is very carefully created and curated. I mean, I hate to speak for them, but yeah, based on all their other work and the fact that they build entire sets just to make photographs or to build a very particular story that they have written out from front to end, I would put all my money on them building these sets specifically to make that photograph. Yes?
Whenever I look at these photographs, on the edge of action. Like, they're, even this one that looks very calm, they're making a big decision, they're about to do something. Do you think that is the lighting? What do you think? Do you really feel this way? Like, that they're about to spring into some sort of important situation. But I don't know if it's just because they're kind of spotlighted, or...
Yeah, I mean... Right. I think so much of that is all the elements that we are borrowing from film.
Yeah.
Because I think these are scenes that, even though we haven't seen any of these in particular in a film, if you tried to point it out, I mean, they seem to me like that sort of creeper view where, you know, who, like the one right behind you, it's like we're in the closet looking at her. I mean, that's a weird space to be staring at someone and not staring at the whole, you know, the whole body or the face.
I don't know. That's why I feel kind of naughty looking at them or something. Because, I mean, like you're saying, the creeper view of them, it seems like you're right. Something.
It's very voyeuristic. And even more interesting that all of it's intentional. So the person who's sitting there is sitting specifically for this photograph, for these artists, but yet they create that whole feel. Yes.
Do they have a story in mind, whether or not we know it, what it is? I don't think they tell us, but do they have a story? This is what this guy...
Well, most of the work that they're known for is film pieces. And a lot of times their films will run on a loop. So when you walk into the piece, it's on a loop. There's not, you know, ideally you don't really know where it starts and stops. And sometimes they will film things literally on a round track so that you don't, you know, it's this constantly evolving perspective, but you don't know where they started and where they stopped. And so there are these elements they give us of a story, but they never give us the whole story. So it's very intentional that it's fragmented and we don't quite know what's happened. So on an individual photograph, I don't know that they created a story from, you know, as their homework. I feel like we're starting to get into their process, and I hate to speak to that because I don't know exactly the process they went through in making this work, but they definitely are very intentional about only giving us fragmented elements. You know, they're interested in the construction of the narrative and then not giving us a whole narrative, just giving us these pieces that we kind of feel are these true, genuine moments, but they're not. They're fully constructed. Okay, so in keeping with that voyeuristic element of artists looking in on creeping on people's lives, we're going to go back around this corner and we'll end up staying in that gallery for the rest of the talk. He has another series where he goes in and kind of finds these interventions within nature, like a leaf, and he sews the leaf together where there's a hole in it. I mean, so we're talking about pretty quiet work. If you think of how an artist works in a studio, very internal. You know, he did an entire book of sock monkeys. It was one collector's collection of all these handmade sock monkeys, and he photographed thousands of them in his studio. So again, very internalized process. So he inherited from a friend of his a lens that's really created for bird watching, or at least that's what he says that lens would be used for. It's a 500 millimeter lens. So just to give you guys an idea, if we're talking about a 35 millimeter camera, my favorite lens that I use would be the equivalent of like a 17 millimeter. We call this a very wide lens so that I can squeeze a lot in. And basically the higher the number, the longer that lens gets, the more of a telephoto it is, the more it zooms in. So if you guys have noticed people at sports games that are taking photographs, you know, and they have those ridiculously long lenses, that might be a 300 millimeter lens. You know, they're pretty expensive. So 500, I mean, we're talking like a very, very expensive piece of glass. And so he inherits this friend, he inherits this lens from a friend, and the friend used it because he was an avid bird watcher. And so Arnie lives in New York City, and he said, I wanted to experiment with this lens and see what I could get. So he looks out the window, and obviously he says, my neighbors, all of the buildings around me, you know, they're actually this really great grid composition of the windows. So he starts looking, and he sets up a tripod, and he starts making photographs out his window when he notices his neighbors open the curtains and do whatever, you know, live within their spaces. And so for a period of a year, that's all he's doing. You know, he's outside looking at his neighbors all around, and people would, you know, come home, open the curtains, live their lives, close the curtains. Well, when that curtain's open, he's watching and he's taking photographs. He ends up over a year taking thousands and thousands of photographs of his neighbors. And so he has a gallery in New York, the Julie Saul Gallery. It's a really well-respected, great gallery. And they plan a show, and in the lead-up to the show, there are a couple of different neighborhood weeklies that publish a couple of the photographs and write a piece about the show. Well, there's a couple that sees a photograph and they're horrified because it's the woman, their names are Matthew and Martha Foster. And so they look and see that Martha is in a photograph holding her son, who's in a diaper, and her daughter standing next to her in her bathing suit. And this is one of the photographs that's going to be shown in the gallery. And, you know, it's already in this weekly that's circulating. So his neighbors had absolutely no idea they were being photographed. So remember, just a moment ago, we were talking about how the photograph changes behavior. Well, in this one, it's not changing it at all because his subjects are completely unaware that they're a subject for his camera. So they took it to a New York Supreme Court because they were very offended at the fact that, I mean, their direct quote is, they were frightened and angered at the artist's utter disregard for their privacy. So it goes to the New York Supreme Court, and they eventually rule that the photograph is fine because it's protected under the First Amendment as a work of art. And part of what came out as the process, I mean, Arnie's process as he started this work is that he consulted with a lawyer before he ever made any of the photographs, and he watched Rear Window, Alfred Hitchcock's movie with Jimmy Stewart. He watched that 4 times over a period of a year. He was really interested in this. And so a lot of the photographs that he takes, they're sort of these fragmented shots. And he said he was very interested in how these photographs are about humankind and they're about the gesture, you know, and he doesn't think that they're really about the individuals in the shots. They're sort of more about our humanity and, you know, how we live. And so you can see, you know, this woman's slippers and she's at the edge of her space. So would it surprise any of you to know that he was very surprised with the reaction to his work? He was actually really surprised that it was controversial or that it made people angry. And he actually pulled the photograph that I was describing of the woman and her 2 children. He pulled that from the show. I think he became a little bit more protective of the images of people with their children. And so after that first court ruling that his work was protected as works of art, because their lawyer tried to argue that this was actually advertisement leading up to a show, so it constituted commerce and advertising, which would technically not make it protected by the First Amendment, but they tried to appeal that decision, and they were told that they'd have no grounds for appealing, that it was definitely artwork. So I'm curious what you guys think, sort of knowing that backstory, especially those of you who didn't know this coming into seeing the work. Does it change it at all for you? No? I just have head shaking now.
I didn't know a bit about the kids. That changes it a little bit for me.
So why does that change it?
I don't know. I was just trying to think why it did. Because, you know, you think, well, kids don't have a choice, but nobody has a choice. So I don't know why it changes this for me if there are children in the shot. But otherwise, it doesn't feel like that's a big deal.
So he ended up reaching out to most of his neighbors, like finding email addresses and contacting them and telling them about the photographs. And some of the responses, I mean, there was a woman who said, you know, we all live our lives in New York City in these very small apartments and spaces, and so we cannot live our whole lives with our curtains closed, and we just hope that our neighbors have the decency when we open the curtains to have light and a little bit more, you know, the perception of more space, that our neighbors will be respectful of that.
You know, to me, this is just the way life apartments in New York City works. It's kind of unfortunate that spaces are suffering. But Anna Marvell surprised them when they were going to the neighbors.
Right, yeah. Go ahead.
I've always taken the fact that all neighbors, because to me, neighbor, there's this concept of neighborliness. There's this understanding that you would sit in a neighbor, or if you found a dog, you would look for Turnip. But that's not always a gift. And in this case, he's acting unneighborly according to what a lot of us might hope, you know?
Yeah.
Like what that woman said, there's hope for our neighbors, respect. And it's just a matter
of right, right. Very unspoken sort of trust that he violated in making this work and then selling it in a gallery. And
but he's always had an optimistic face.
Right.
So that's interesting. In my mind, if I were in one of these photographs, if I were that pregnant woman, I would not want that in a child. This is very tender and personal, but this one seems like
it could be anyone. And you know, what he says about the work is that in all of them, it could be anyone. You know, it's just about the gesture, and it's about us in a much bigger way. And I think in writing the email to his neighbors, he was trying to sort of plead his case and explain it and hope that they would sort of come to see the work in the same way that he was coming to see it. I mean, for me, the most surprising element is that he did not expect any of the pushback that his work got. Terry.
In working at them, this one not so much. In a way, in most of them, there seems to be this kind of visual, pure visual relief to content. And to me, that somehow plays into this issue. I'm also struck by the fact that you can identify that there is something between you and them. You know, unlike holes, you're not looking as if you are, you know, hiding. There's actually, you see the glass.
Sure, the barricade between.
Yeah. It becomes a division. Reflections on the glass identify it. And then also just notions of surveillance, especially in big cities. And it's such a false sense to think that there's such a thing as privacy in a way. And, you know, it just seconds philosophically.
Absolutely. Yeah. Did you have something?
Well, I was just going to say, I'd always heard that photographers can take a picture or photograph of anyone in a public place. No question ever whatsoever. And we had David Carter at the Sitter, who was a photographer, that had her art, and she took it to someone. And the only time she ever has permission is that you can't show it. The only, actually, I like this. I think it's an interesting idea, but that's partly a public place. So the fact that it's okay. I mean, it means you can always take a photograph and make money.
Right. Right, and I think that so much of why this is interesting is everyone is in their private spaces living, you know, living their ordinary lives with no idea. Sure, sure, with their curtains open. And, you know, I think we're fascinated by these notions. I mean, that's why we love Rear Window, or that's why I love it. You know, this idea that we can peek in on other people's lives. And, you know, I know even when I drive home, when I'm driving home and I see my neighbors in the evening, you know, with their curtains open and they have a dinner party, I totally slow down and look at their, oh, that's a cool looking kitchen, and they look like they're having a great time. You know, I think that we all do that. It's a part of human nature. And you know, I think that in so many ways, if he didn't make this work, someone else was going to make this work in New York City, you know, where it seems like everyone sort of lives on top of each other. So does that mean if your windows are open, are you careful that you're always closed if you walk by the windows?
Mostly.
I mean, because I mean, I will regularly walk through the house without clothes on, you know, and not really think about it, but...
Yeah, I mean, I'm very aware of the fact that we kind of made that agreement with the world that we, you know,
sure.
Yeah, I feel like this, that in some ways I find this really touching in that way. This is not, that the subject of that photograph is not those two people, except to the people who know those two people.
Right. Yeah, I agree with that. So that's a nice segue, thinking about privacy, if everyone wants to just turn around. So the last work we'll talk about is work that I had to do absolutely no research on for today's talk. So these are all photographs of love hotels in Japan. And I lived in Japan for almost a year, a few years ago. I was living over there teaching English in two public high schools, and I really went because I wanted to live in a place for a while, not worry about taking photographs for a living, and just photograph whatever element of the culture I found interesting. And it took me a while to find love hotels, but once I discovered them and realized what they actually were, I became pretty fascinated with this idea of being able to look at a culture and look at romance and love within a culture through a very specific institution, and that's the Love Hotel. So at the time that I took these photographs, you know, an interesting fact about Japan and Texas, Japan has roughly the same landmass that the state of Texas does, only there are a lot of uninhabitable spaces like the tops of mountains and mountain ranges. So there were 30,000 love hotels in Japan the year that I was taking these photographs. And there were 7,000 Starbucks in Texas. So, you know, there were there were several love hotels in Japan for every photograph, I'm sorry, for every Starbucks that was here. So they're really ubiquitous. They are everywhere. They are not just some obscure thing. They're really an element of the culture that my experience was no one was talking about, no one wanted to talk about. But they were so prevalent that one of the Love Hotel's managers I was talking to said, he said, why do you want to photograph Japanese Love Hotels? And I said, these are really fascinated. I'm pretty taken with them, you know, culturally, and they're pretty creative. And he said, oh, what are American love hotels like? You know? I mean, he just took it for granted that these are everywhere. So love hotels are a pretty interesting element of the culture, at least for an outsider, because they are rooms that are rented by the hour. They're typically themed rooms, and they really operate on this notion of privacy. So when you enter a love hotel, this is most of the love hotels, I understand this is not every love hotel in the country, but for most of the love hotels, when you enter the room, when you enter a lobby, there will be a board that has love hotels that are available. You know, the rooms that are available. They'll be lit from behind, or, you know, now a lot of them have moved to computer screens. But on the older ones, there'll be a picture of the room will be lit from behind if it's available. If it's dark, it's either occupied or it's being cleaned. And once you choose your room, they have sort of different rates on them. You push a button next to that photograph, and arrows start flashing to direct you to the room. So you're not actually interfacing with a person when you walk into the lobby. And so you walk to, you know, where the arrows are instructing you. Your room is unlocked. You go in. The door actually locks when you close it. And they have payment systems that you must pay for that room before you leave. So there are some of the hotels will have pneumatic tube systems. Those are the same tube systems. You know, if you drive into your bank teller and you're sitting in your car to do your banking, you know, the pneumatic tubes go back and forth. So there will be a whole system of those in a hotel, you know, with tubes that go to every room so you can make the payment at the end. A lot of them have credit card machines that are, you know, inside at the doors. You have to insert your payment before you walk out of the room. And everything, all the common areas like the hallways and the lobby and the parking lots are all monitored by, you know, closed circuit video so that they can time when people are in the hallways so that no maid service or hotel staff is in the hallway when they're there. So there's really this feeling when you walk into a love hotel like, no one is in the entire building. I mean, it's a pretty fascinating and unusual experience in Japan, where it's such a crowded place and you're constantly with people all the time. And I think that the modern selection of these five photographs, I mean, there's a book of love hotels that I did, 70 photographs, but I think the selection of these five is a pretty interesting and good selection. You know, this is a waiting room, so you are not allowed to go to a hotel room by yourself. So you have to, if you're meeting your partner there, then you have to go and wait in one of the different decorated lobbies until your partner arrives and the two of you can go to the room together. I asked a manager why it is that no one's allowed to go to the rooms by themselves, and he said that the loneliness of the spaces and the isolation makes people more vulnerable to suicide. There's a, you know, this empty hallway, also very decorated, the trees. And then there's three photographs from rooms. And so the rooms that I photographed were really focused on fantasies, all kinds of fantasies. So you can see there's a pirate ship room. This is actually a room that changed when you turned off the lights. This photograph is the room with the lights turned off. So this is actually black light. And so that was a sunset that was painted on the wall, and then once you turn the lights off, it's a pirate ship. You know, it kind of changes. And you can see there's this S&M element that's there because you have, you know, the mast of the ship implied here, and then where you can chain your partner in. The red caged bed is the only room that I got to photograph before it was cleaned. So you can see the slippers that were used, the bed's not made up, but there's obviously this bondage theme that's happening. This was a device just on the corner where you would set someone in it and put their feet in these spaces that are spread out and chain them down to that. The whole bed had chains all over it. And then the carousel room, which looks very bright and poppy. I mean, I love kind of the candy colors that sort of attract you to at first, but I think when you start looking and you notice that there is a mural of children, it's projected pretty large on the side, and when you start thinking about the fact that you're talking now about a sexual fantasy that's based around a carousel and these components of childhood, it starts to kind of change the photograph from this bright, poppy, colorful thing that you enter into something that's a fantasy that we might be pretty uncomfortable with over here. So I would really love for this part of our conversation, or this part of the talk, to become more of a conversation. I'm really curious about what you guys see here, and if you have questions for me. Yes. Yes, I think both those things are at play, actually, because, you know, in Japan, people live with their parents until they get married. So you also have situations where housing is so expensive, you will have, you know, a living room that in the evening you pull out the futons and that becomes the bedroom, and whole families are sleeping in the same room. So in a Love Hotel, it could be anyone who has sex that's renting the Love Hotel for privacy and some time alone, but you also have explicit relationships that are happening, or sort of forbidden relationships. You know, there's a phrase that I heard a lot called compensation dating, and the idea is that when two people have an exchange, the woman is given a gift, like a Gucci handbag, you know, a very expensive gift. So prostitution by another name. You know, there are relationships that are much more common with huge age gaps, like a young girl and an older man. There are affairs that happen at Love Hotels. Sometimes people, you know, will pay for a prostitute's services once she meets them at a Love Hotel. So it's kind of like every element of the society that might be having sex could be using a Love Hotel. Well, there are some love hotels, like the ones that are much older, where there actually is a person behind a desk. Or I went into one where there was a giant piece of opaque glass, and there was about a 5 or 6 inch opening at the bottom, and so you would just see hands on the other side, so you know the person's there telling you which room to go to. But a lot of the newer ones are really pride themselves on this whole, you know, empty feeling space. And, you know, culturally, it's a place where people are very private about their inner lives and don't talk about a lot of things. So it is completely anonymous. You know, Japan is really a cash-based society. That's changing a little bit, but most people don't use credit cards. So, you know, thus the pneumatic tubes in the rooms, you know, that whole system to get your cash without ever having to interact with someone who works at the hotel. Yes?
you know, hey, what you want to eat and gave you little tickets and you go to the table and put out a ticket so that you want to buy a ticket for you. There's a lot of stuff that's set up there.
It's automated. Yeah, a lot that's automated. I mean, and there's been a lot that's been written about the things that you can get in vending machines in Japan, you know, from the very bizarre to like a 5-pound bag of rice from a vending machine or beer from a vending machine.
So I'm curious about the history of these local hotels. I'm thinking about courtesans and floating world, you know, from the Edo period. Do you know anything about how far back they go?
When they started,
yeah.
You know, I remember reading that World War II, the war was really where they started. But I don't know. I mean, my focus was really the modern Love Hotel, because those older Love Hotels, you know, I entered some of them. I just wasn't as interested in them because these were, you know, these catering to the, you know, the wildest fantasies that I could imagine was part of what drew me into them. And a lot of the older hotels don't have that wild element of fantasy. There's not as much S&M in them. I mean, the things that were really so eye-popping weren't in the older ones as much. Yes?
One, do you have a structure to each photo?
So your first question regarding the structure of them, I kind of entered the rooms and was really just interested in, I mean, like this room behind me had a bed, so I actually photographed every room from probably a minimum of 6 different angles. You know, I'd spend a while in each room, and I really just pulled the images that I thought kind of boil down to what the fantasy was or what that room was all about, and, you know, the theme. Your second question about why I would have included these other elements that are not just the rooms. Well, I think that all goes to that, you know, element of what the Love Hotel is. You know, this very anonymous sort of empty space. I mean, even the hallways decorated, you know, like this outdoor trees, you know, park feeling that exists in the hallway. I mean, I think that all leads into this idea of creating fantasy around a sexual encounter. I think that feeds into it. Yes?
My assumption would be that the proprietors of these scholarships are male. Would it be safe to say that these would be male fantasies?
You know, I think that culturally, most of the, you know, there was actually a kind of funny thing that happened when I started shooting this, because I read about these in the guidebook that I had, you know, just as a general guidebook of Japan, and it was saying that some of the rooms would be very bizarrely decorated, and so I thought, I just want to see them. They just sound really interesting. And I ended up walking into a Love Hotel at one point because I thought that's what it might be. It was this building with Santa Clauses climbing all over the top of the building. And it was called Chapel Little Christmas or Hotel Little Christmas. And so I walked in, and there was like an automated Santa Claus playing at the piano and no one around anywhere. And I actually wandered around the hotel, and I went in the elevator, and I went up. I had my camera. I just started taking photos because there was no one around. I couldn't even ask anyone. And I thought, this is so weird. No one's here. I'm sure now that they were all sitting there going, what is she doing? You know, watching me on these various monitors. Like, now she's getting in the elevator. Why does she have a camera? So eventually I went and knocked on a door that looked like a private door, you know, like not a hotel room door, and talked to someone, and they're like, you can take photos in the hall, but not nowhere else. And I thought, but the rooms are what are going to be most interesting here. And so I tried to find a translator who would help me have access. Well, I was, you know, doing this, I was teaching while I was there, and so I didn't know if this would ever become anything at all. I mean, these could have just all hit the cutting room floor for me in the studio. So I couldn't afford to pay a legitimate, you know, professional translator their regular day rate to go shoot these spaces. So I found in an English language paper, there was an exchange where you could just do like a language trade with someone, and you would meet someone at coffee, and that way, you know, you would speak some Japanese, they would speak some English, and you would sort of have a language exchange. So I contacted people who put ads out that they wanted to do exchanges, because I thought, well, they would actually get some good practice with English doing this, and I could pay them something, you know, not the professional fees. And so in Japanese culture, just as a general rule, women do not approach men for sex, for sexual encounters. It is all one-sided. You know, it's man approaches woman. So we were also told in teaching, do not ever meet a student for coffee, because coffee is the most romantic thing that you can do. You know, here it's the least commitment, right? The most casual, like, oh, let's have coffee. You know, it's not dinner. It's not the commitment of a meal. And so so I'm meeting these people who could potentially, oh, and I made sure they were men, because the culture is slightly misogynistic. And so I'm sitting across from this man. This actually happened two times to me. Both encounters were very similar. And I told the guy what I wanted to do, and I had a list of love hotels I'd researched that I thought might be very interesting for this. And he said, oh, yeah, that sounds good, that sounds good. So we made a date, and so on that day, he said, okay, let's meet at this place, this coffee shop first, before we go there. So we meet at the coffee shop, and I said, okay, should we call these first and ask if they'll let us go in, you know, and not waste our time just driving to them? And he said, oh, no, no, we just have to go. And I said, are you sure? And he goes, we'll have one shot at asking. Trust me, I know Japanese culture. It's much better if we're in person. So, okay. So we show up at this love hotel, and I'm looking at the board. You know, it's lit. Of course, there's no one in sight from the hotel. And he just says, okay, pick the room that you want to go to. And I said, no, no. I mean, keep in mind, I have my giant camera bag with me. I have a really heavy tripod. And he says, no, you just pick the room, and we'll go to the room. And we'll just pay for that room, and you can take whatever photos you want in it. And I said, no, because look, I want to go in this room and this one and this one, and that one looks cool, and if we have time, that one. And so we're kind of arguing about this. I said, we just need to ask. We just need to ask. And finally, this woman comes out, because I'm sure they've been watching us argue from behind the scenes. And she asks, you know, and my Japanese was terrible, but I could understand a little bit. She asks, you know, what's the problem? And he said, it's okay. It's her first time. She's very nervous. Which I understood. And it wasn't a good sign, so I didn't go to any rooms. And that happened two different times. You know, it was slightly different the second time. And so I said, I can't, you know, obviously this is not going to happen. And so I was telling another woman who was doing the same type of work that I was doing, and she said, oh, my boyfriend is an English teacher. He loves love hotels. He would totally do this with you. So that's how I ended up getting the access. But, you know, I wanted to be really careful after making the work and publishing, you know, I was talking to the publisher about publishing a book. I wanted to be really careful about being a foreigner talking about the role of love hotels within another culture. So I actually had read a book by a writer, Netsuo Kurino, who's a phenomenal fiction writer. And her understanding of Japanese culture, I thought, was pretty unique for someone who'd lived their whole life in Japan. I mean, she's traveled extensively, but she seems pretty fair about Japanese culture. So we approached her and asked her if she would write an essay about the role of love hotels in the book, and she did. But her first draft was so shocking that we wrote her back and said, there's no way that we can use it as it is. We have to cut some things out. So I went and met with her in Tokyo and showed her the photographs, you know, to ask her if she would write. And she was interested, and I said, you know, they're very bright and poppy and have this jewel-like color to them, which I think once you really start looking at the photographs, you see there is something kind of darker in them. Well, her first draft of the the essay, she opened it by talking about a man who was in a love hotel with a prostitute. He killed her, he cut her up, he put her back behind the headboard, and no one knew. The room was used for 2 weeks until the smell was so terrible that they couldn't use the room anymore. And that's why I just about fell over when I read her draft and said, we really can't, I mean, it will just become that in every room, you know, if that's how the book opens, so. All right, way to end this. Well, thank you, guys.